wrong. I went a little further with Yik Yak because I saw enough traction and could see the next chess moves. Since then, it's declined. It never made that pivot. Anonymous doesn't work, guys. Any place where we're allowed to be the worst versions of ourselves eventually become places none of us want to hang out. And so, the marketing opportunities, I think, are waning, which is unfortunate. I think they have very smart founders, really interesting potential. But at this moment, as I record this, I don't see it.
Which industries do you think will leverage Meerkat the best? And who is their target user?
At the time of this question, Meerkat was on fire, which was a live streaming app. I quickly moved and invested in it in my Vayner RSC fund. For people that have been following my career, though, as a matter of fact, it's happening right now in my actions. I'm only periscoping right now, and I'm not meerkatting, even though I invested in Meerkat. Same thing I did with Foursquare and Gowalla. So at the time of this answer, my reputation matters more than any investment I make. So at the time, I talked a lot about Meerkat as a QVC-like product because I still believe live streaming is very, very good for that. But it's clear right now that I should almost replace the word Meerkat with Periscope unless Ben, a CEO I believe in so much, can pivot the product and create more opportunities for Meerkat to grow. But the live streaming on a phone thing is huge, right? If you think about it, breaking news, right? Humans being able to capture things before the TV cameras get there. QVC selling like dynamics. Live talk shows, replicating what happens on radio during drive time radio. There's so many things that can happen with live stream apps. I'm very bullish on it. I used Facebook Live right now during this recording session. I'm a huge fan of all these platforms. You should pay attention to them.
What do you think of Yo's new updates? Can businesses use them to communicate to users?
At a time, I said, listen, if you're a business that thinks you can get value out of communicating to your audience on Yo, go do it. Yo was super interesting. It was a cute little kind of tech thing, but it ended up being more of a feature, in my opinion. I just don't see any excitement right this minute for businesses on Yo.
How will the world change in 2018 once the Apple Watch has probably become a vital part in everyone's lives?
Wow, wow. The Apple Watch is not a vital part of anybody's life right now. And even though I was super excited about it and many others, it just didn't click. Google Glass, the wearable thing is tricky, man. You know, putting something on your body is different. That's going to be, by the way, whoever figures that out, you want to talk about a $1 trillion business? So look, smartification of society is coming. Everything in our lives being smart is going to happen. The same way that everybody said the internet in 1996 was going to change the world in 2000. Yeah, it kind of started really changing in 2010, right? And so I think things like the watch and glasses and things of that nature is more a 2025 phenomenon than a 2016 phenomenon. And so I guess this is kind of fun to answer, which is I just don't think it's happening.
Disney's Magic Band. How do you see the space evolving? What do you think about the necessity for these online, offline bridge technologies?
I'm a huge fan of wearable technologies, like I just referenced. I think it's a little far away, but the days of your sneaker talking to you, the days of getting a wristband that like follows everything you do, I'm excited about. I want a tool that actually tells me the exact calorie intake I'm taking day in and day out. You want to talk about a very easy way to lose weight? If I literally had it right on my wrist, I could just look at it. If I knew the exact number I was at, boy, even portion control, you know, even if you were undereducated on what the calorie count was, you bite one bite and it goes up. I mean, incredible stuff is coming. I'm a big fan of it. I think it's going to change our world. I do believe that the cell phone is the first step into us becoming robots. I think this next generation of products will show it even more with the glasses, the watch, and all that. And I think it's going to be a major industry in the next 30, 40, 50, forever years, really. I think we're in the dawn of the smartification of every product in the world. I think this water bottle sitting right next to me right now will eventually talk to me and say, hey, I'm getting too warm for consumption. Or, hey, if you're not going to use me on those plants over there. You know, I think this is really, really coming.
What are your thoughts on Facebook advertising on television?
So Facebook was running ads in the UK, and this is where this came from, and I actually thought it was brilliant. And I know this is going to throw people literally just said, huh? You know, because I rail on TV advertising because I think it's overpriced, and it is. And because I'm a huge advocate of Facebook, why don't they run ads on their own platform? That's the point. They've basically gotten everybody on Earth on the platform in countries that are allowed to market, except for a small group that is most likely watching TV. What Facebook is brilliantly doing is realizing that the small percentage of citizens that have not signed up for their account are probably on the older demo that are focused on TV, and they can absolutely advertise and convert them there. I applaud them for respecting the attention platform for the audience that they're trying to reach. They didn't do it in 07, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. They did it in 15, right? And so I still think you should do every platform if you think it can bring value to you, as long as it's bringing you the most value for that dollar spent. Even though it's expensive for Facebook to run on TV, it's valuable because there's just no other way to get that person.
Hey, it's Zach again, and I designed the cover of this book, which you can't see because it's an audiobook, so you'll have to take my word for it. I just bought an indoor billboard company. How do you feel about advertising in the bathroom?
I'm a huge fan of it. I'm obsessed with attention. I don't care if it's digital or traditional or historic, for that matter. When you take a pee and you're looking at the wall and you see an ad, you see it. Now, do I like it as much as I liked it 3 years ago? No. Let me tell you why. Because now when I go take a pee, I'm looking at my phone simultaneously. And so are all the dudes at VaynerMedia. You guys know who you are. I see you every day. You're taking a pee and you're checking ESPN or Instagram. So, it's not as valuable anymore because of consumer behavior. People's eyes have shifted, and so 4, 5, 6 years ago, it was more valuable. But I'm still pretty bullish on it, because some people still think it's not really clean to do that. And so they're respectful, and they're consuming your ad at their eye level.
When will social marketing spending be bigger than television commercials?
So first, let's say this. Let's say that we can all agree that social marketing spending could be called internet platforms instead of social, because it gets tough here, but not banner ads, not Google AdWords, these Facebook, Snapchat, things of that nature. So if we continue to use that term, but I want to throw kind of, you know, not YouTube, yeah, YouTube, you know, things like that, a little bit different. I would say this, it doesn't really matter. I don't really care. I prefer that it happens later than sooner, because that means I'll still be land grabbing actual attention while people overspend. And I really don't know. I know this, that the media buying agencies of the world are holding back the shift because they make more profit in other areas than they do here. It takes a lot to plan Facebook ads properly. And so in that way, it's going to take longer because there's humans that have vested interest in the old guard. But look, this is inevitable. I mean, anybody that looks at a 10-year-old in America, guys, there's nobody under 13 in America that watches television. I mean, just wrap your head around it. They are absolutely in their phones and their mobile devices. Like, yes, maybe the occasional Netflix. And think about that. That's not TV commercials. So this is happening whether you like it or not.
Hey, this is Scott Weidenkiewicz, photographer and educator at scottweiden.com. And here's my question for the Ask Gary V book. So I've been using Instagram with strategic tagging hashtags and also using the profile URL in order to drive some potential print sales. I've also been manually reaching out to local stores that might be interested in hanging my photos. Do you have any suggestions for me and other photographers about other ways to drive local print sales?
This is super cool. Great question. Thank you, Scott, for being so detailed with it. Look, I think both executions, it was fun for me to hear him talk about the URL in the profile that we talked about earlier, so Scotty's paying attention. I think one of the other ways is to search hashtags of the local area and reach out to those businesses and ask them if you can take over their Instagram for a week and then put out cool content on their platform, which also then tags your profile and gives you awareness with that audience. I think that's the number one tactic that photographers can use, because they're getting awareness siphoned from a local audience, and then they get on your page and then they can buy the prints there. I think the other way is, you know, are actually kind of old school. I think, you know, going door to door. This is a very weird answer. Knocking on people's door and calling people. Like, I want to say this because, guys, using a new technology to sell a physical good is something that I'm fascinated by because I don't want anybody to punt the old ways of selling physical goods. I don't think that Instagram and Facebook solves everything. I think the tried and true, I mean, I'm making people use the phone and call people more at Wine Library because it's valuable too. Like, so I think this was a good opportunity to also say, listen, you can't just go all in social in the same way you can't just be all in on the old way.
If you created a social media platform, what would be the key feature and why?
Anybody who's been close to me, big shout out to MSG, Joe Stump, and all my homies. You guys know, 6 years now, I've been talking shit, but I haven't executed about a social network that only allows you to post once a day. I'm a big fan of restrictions. That's why I think that Snapchat and Twitter, both one, disappearing in 24 hours or 140 characters. I love restrictions. And I think the ultimate restriction is stopping from people to yell every single thought and piece of crap content that's on their mind. If you could only say one thing every 24 hours, think about how valuable that would actually be. It would actually be the single most valuable thing you do. Or more importantly, how much it meant to somebody if you said happy birthday to them because that was the most important thing to you that day. It ups the value. And so for a long time, I've wanted to build that. Chapter 10. Facebook ads. In this chapter, I'll talk about taking advantage of other people's emotions, how to market products people are embarrassed to admit they use, and how practice makes perfect. As of recording of this book in early 2016, Facebook ads, also known as unpublished page posts, are the single best advertising digital product for entrepreneurs and Fortune 500 companies that I've seen since buying the keyword wine through Google AdWords in 2004. I didn't realize it at first. Facebook has been an evolving ad product for the last few years, starting off slow with ads on the right side of the desktop like any other banner advertising. When I started to see ads in a newsfeed, it made a lot of sense to me. It's huge and in your face when you look at it in the screen of your phone. Still, I didn't have a eureka moment until a few months later, well into 2014. It was only when I looked at the data and the results of the early Facebook ad campaigns that I started getting bullish and recognized that this was going to be a huge game changer. So did a few others, but not everyone. In fact, a lot of people were hysterical in 2014 and 2015 that Facebook would make changes that would compromise its organic reach on fan pages in favor of ads. Journalists, pundits, and execs who had never run a Facebook ad were publishing articles about how all the young people were migrating to Snapchat and Instagram and threatening Facebook's domination. People were so angry and emotional that they resisted exploring Facebook's capabilities and trying out the new ad product. But I and other real practitioners, the kind of people who spend lots of time in the dirt, recognized that this emotional narrative was creating an outstanding arbitrage opportunity, and we jumped to take advantage of it. The more people bashed Facebook and swore its effectiveness was on the decline, the fewer people were trying out the new ad platform. And since Facebook is a supply and demand marketplace, the price only goes up when advertisers bid for the audience, just like Google AdWords. There was therefore an incredible golden era in 2014 and 2015, where the intrepid marketers who weren't wasting their breath complaining and were willing to experiment could get tremendous reach to the exact people they wanted with a bunch of different creative and see tangible results. That, my friends, reflects the difference between how practitioners and headline readers operate. We've never had an ad product with incredible accuracy, one that could target age, sex, occupation, and on top of that, behaviors and interests. By partnering up with data mining companies, Facebook can now tell us not only the demographics of its users, but their buying histories, both online and off. You can literally target one ad to 19-year-old men with facial hair who live in Phoenix and drink Red Bull, and send another one to 23-year-old women in Detroit who wear contact lenses and play golf. I'm a 40-year-old male who lives in Manhattan and loves the New York Jets and root beer. Imagine what a phenomenally cost-effective transaction you can instigate if you hit my emotional center by putting in my line of vision a root beer with a green football. The only challenge is figuring out the psychology of your audience and determining what story will most likely compel them to make a purchase. If you learn to interpret the available data correctly and deploy it with creative calls to action against the right demo at the right time on the right platform, you're golden. Theoretically, Facebook ads allow you to create a unique, native, relevant ad to every user on Facebook. I'm convinced this period will be heralded as one of the great eras of advertising, alongside early TV advertising, early direct mail advertising, and early Google AdWords. By the time you listen to this, people will be flooding to this product. It's possible that Facebook ads will no longer be as effective as they once were now that more people have caught on to their extraordinary capabilities. Slowly, the supply and demand will force the ads to a more appropriate price. I'll still be bullish about it, and I believe it will be a monster platform in 2016, 2017, and beyond, even becoming the bedrock of people's advertising plans. As always, even in the most saturated market, there is an ROI in putting out your content on anything that consumers are paying attention to, so long as you know how to execute, preferably better than anyone else.
Hi there, this is Dana Anderson. I am the CMO for Mondelez International, and I'm so excited to be reading some of these questions in the Ask Gary V book. Thanks for having me. What's the best way to use Facebook ads and the right price to pay?
Dana is an incredible marketer with an illustrious career, so I'm very honored to have you, Dana, and a great customer of VaynerMedia's Mondelez, so thank you so, so, so much. The best way to use Facebook ads at the right price is to reverse engineer backwards if it's creating the ROI that you're looking for. Meaning, if you're willing to pay $17 to get somebody to buy a case of wine because you make $18 in profit, well then the right price is $17.99. Or, if you think about the world the way I do, the right price might be $23.18 because I'm okay because that's worth it for me for them to buy for me and they'll make money on their second transaction. So like any other platform, the right price is predicated on the results. But remember, the creative is the variable of success. So you might be paying the right price, $12 CPM, which means you're reaching 1,000 people for $12, but your creative stinks. So you got to not only test the groups that you're targeting, but you've got to test the creative that you're making to see them line up to create that business outcome.
What's the best way to use Facebook ads to grow audiences on other platforms?
At the time on the show, I actually said you shouldn't, but I'm going to tweak this a little bit. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I'm doing it right now on Instagram. I'm going to try a little bit on Snapchat. You know, at the end of the day, if you can convert, again, it's no different than the last question, you're going to pay more. You're going to pay more for the friction of them leaving Facebook to go to Snapchat to follow you or to go to Twitter and follow you. So, as long as you understand that you're probably usually better off spending advertising money on the platform to get people to follow you on that platform, aka running Instagram ads to follow you on Instagram versus running Facebook ads to get to follow you on Instagram, then you understand where I'm coming from. However, if you deem that Facebook's targeting capabilities, so let me explain. If I want, and you know what? I may do this now after this book. This book's inspiring me. If I want to target 18 to 25 year olds on Facebook that are fans of Shark Tank, which, you know, I know that there's not that many 18 to 25-year-olds paying attention, but way more than anybody else thinks. There's millions that are doing it. They're just not checking it every 3 minutes. And I want to build up my Snapchat. If I'm willing to pay $18 a user for Snapchat because I've decided that, well, then I can run it on Facebook. So the punchline is this. It would be expensive to use Facebook to build up audience at other places, but believe it or not, it just might be valuable for some of you.
Which marketing vehicles are best to grow startups you've invested in?
To me, this is a Facebook, Google AdWords world. It's very quant-driven. You can see the results. I think that there's been some startups, if you look at Dollar Shave Club, which is a company that I did not invest in, but made a remarkable video that YouTube helped explode. But no question, if you look at the current startups, Facebook, Google AdWords, some in-ad advertising within apps, if it's an app itself, so some of the Apple iAds or things of that nature, Flurry, things of that nature. So there's a lot of different things depending on the startup, but for me, it's a Facebook, Google world.
As a rookie, how much should I allocate to Facebook ads for a Teespring campaign?
Well, I think Facebook for t-shirts is just incredible. And I think that with Teespring, at the time I created a narrative on my show where I said, look, if you're going to make an original t-shirt that says Denver truck drivers rule, and then you target men that live in Denver whose occupation is working for a trucking company, you've got a really good shot of selling some t-shirts. So again, if you want to say, you know, men from Alabama love fishing, and then you literally target men from Alabama who have interest in fishing, you're going to sell some t-shirts. So I'm a very big fan, and you can do it for $20. If you see that you sold 3 shirts and you're like, oh my God, that really works, then you pour more, you know, fluid on the fire. So I would say there is no minimum allocation. I would say for practical terms, spend $100. Spend $100, create your target, put your creative, and see what happens.
How should marketers engage with an audience that is generally reluctant to talk publicly about the needs we can fill? For example, hair replacement products.
I think there's some assumptions being made here. For example, Rogaine has, at the time when I did the show, 36,000 followers on Facebook. And I would have thought it would be zero. I get where that person's coming from, and depends at the time. I mean, this is like adult Pampers, guys. 26,000 people willing to like it to get coupons or talk about it or create a community. So people are becoming more open. That's number one. So don't make any assumptions on how the industry has been. The new generation is much more comfortable in their skin. We're living open lives more. Now, I don't think Rogaine's going to have 3.6 million followers. And there's probably 15 million, 100 million people that want to use it. So I get that. So let's think about it a secondary way. A secondary way is, what's the chess move to get to that person? You know, doctors, WebMD, Dr. Oz. You see where I'm going kind of there? Sports therapists. There's just a million ways to get their hairdressers, you know. So who's in industries that are peddling these products? Because I know what you're alluding to, and I think we all do, which is these products that are more private usually have experts in between. You can market against those experts' fan pages or interests, and that's how you can reach the audience you're looking for. Real quick, though, as much as I love Facebook, I will say this. I think that Google AdWords is an incredible platform for those kind of things, because people are searching that kind of stuff in the privacy of their home.
Is it worth paying for a course to learn all about Facebook ads, or is it all right to rely on the free info on YouTube? Are Facebook ads really that complicated?
Facebook ads are quite simple. The product's quite simple for anybody that uses the internet. And so the Facebook data and information and learning courses that are available for free on YouTube are 100% the way to go. You don't need to pay a Facebook expert to teach you how to do Facebook for $500 courses. What you need to be is a practitioner. What you need to do is practice. You don't need to pay somebody to teach you how to hit a baseball, right? You can absolutely watch that online for free. But you have to go out and swing the bat 50,000 times. Do you have that kind of discipline? Too many people, and very honestly, and this is going to hurt for me to say, too many people that listen to me spend $300 to make themselves feel better because they've learned how to use Snapchat and then do nothing about it. And so it's not about paying to learn. It's about having the discipline and the energy to execute. Chapter 11, Influencer Marketing. In this chapter, I talk about where the big bucks are going next, the two biggest influencer opportunities, and how up-and-coming influencers can get advertiser attention. We all know that the thank you economy is based on the power of word of mouth. With one click, or tweet, or share, or favorite, or any number of other social digital acts, consumers' messages can be spread and their voice amplified well beyond the boundaries of their neighborhoods or even the industries where they work. And that's just the ordinary Joes who aren't actually trying to make a name for themselves. There are others, of course, whose word of mouth is even more valuable. These are the people who put in the hustle. Celebrities, for sure, and experts in their fields, but also those people who aren't celebrities in the traditional sense, and yet who are also entertaining, different, or funny, and so good at creating native content, whether it's 6-second Vine videos or pithy tweets or insightful blog posts, they develop a disproportionate effect on pop culture and opinion. Marketing today is about going where the eyeballs go. and the eyeballs are all in on these influencers. Will they see your brand there? You're missing out if they're not. I've known for a long time that one person's passion and personality could carry a brand, especially via video. Companies were reaching out to me as early as 2006, asking if I would integrate their products into Wine Library TV. I didn't take their offers because I wasn't yet sure what the negative side effects might be. And though $5,000 was a nice sum, I was making enough money that it didn't seem worth it at the time. Now, the practice has become commonplace and acceptable. I'm considering getting sponsors for Ask Gary Vee Show. Can you imagine? Ask Gary Vee Show is brought to you by the New York Jets. Back in 2009, when I first wrote about influencer marketing in Crush It, people were still debating whether YouTube was really a major platform. Today, YouTube is the video platform of our society, with Facebook video kind of on its heels, like I said earlier. Influencer marketing is an exploding category. Yet, for all the thousands of dollars being paid to people to post things on social, it is still grossly underpriced in the market. I will always say that I don't like making predictions, but I'm comfortable predicting that whatever the dollar amount influencers are being paid to market services and products in 2016, that money will be dwarfed by 2019. Corporations are going to give massive amounts of money to individuals to help bring awareness on platforms like Snapchat and Instagram and plenty more that don't exist yet. When I first advocated for this kind of marketing, people were still skeptical of the idea that everyone and anyone could develop a personal brand. It was weird. Now, it's becoming the norm. Every 14-year-old knows that if she can get enough followers on Instagram, companies will send her free stuff and pay her to put pictures of products in her feed. And not one 14-year-old watching her is going to think badly of her doing it. You'll see, influencer marketing is going to be one of the advertising bedrocks of the next decade. I believe in this form of marketing so much that in May 2013, I started a talent agency with Jerome Jarre called Grape Story to represent star storytellers on Vine and Snapchat. Since then, I've watched the careers of Logan Paul, Marcus Johns, King Botch, Lele Pons, Nash Greer, and Sean Doris explode, turning them from unknowns into bigger stars to the average 14-year-old than Rihanna. If you're 25 years old or older, these names may not mean anything to you. But for anyone ages 14 to 24, these have been household names for well over 18 months.
Hi, this is Casey Neistat, and I am hiding in my wife's closet with my head in her dresses, trying to get as clear of audio as I can as I record these questions. Where do you see the biggest untapped opportunities in the social media influence space? Where is the next big thing coming?
Casey, you're a real character. Thanks so much for reading. For anybody that doesn't know, Casey's one of the great influencers in our society and a great co-founder of something called Beam and just pushing the envelope. So I'm really happy to have you, brother. So I think the place to really focus on is retail. Right now, a lot of influencers are getting paid for awareness, right? Make a piece of content, push it out to your community. But I think the place where they're going to make a lot more money is when they start endorsing products or creating products for themselves as they amass these huge audiences. For example, if I created a wine glass that was a signature Gary Vaynerchuk wine glass in 2011, I think was my height, I would have sold a lot and made a lot of money. And so I think Casey, who's a photographer, if he came out with his own camera, like a $30 disposable cool 2017 disposable camera, he would sell hundreds of thousands and make a lot of profit. So retail, not just advertising.
How do you define influencer?
Look, at some level, I define influencer as anybody who can have a following that says something and people then take action, right? Now, some of us, we can say, go here, and two people will show up. And other people, for example, DJ Khaled, in an hour can say, fans, meet me downstairs on Snapchat, and literally thousands of people show up. So your influence power varies, but at this point, I pretty much default into anybody that has a social network and has a profile is an influencer. Clearly, the way the market defines it is having enough mass to matter to their business. And so It's very, very intriguing to watch all of us be pushed into the influencer game, and you're more than welcome not to. Hide your account. Don't sign up in the first place. There's one other little bullet point I'd like to mention to add value to the conversation is an influencer can be somebody who's influential in a very narrow space, right? So you don't have to be Tom Cruise of the 80s. You may be a mechanic that is very smart and clever and storytells great on Instagram, and you could be huge to the, you know, auto industry, but mean nothing to anybody else in the world. So let's remember that part as well.
Now that you're running an influencer space with Grape Story, what are the biggest challenges you're facing in scaling the business model? And which brands are doing a good job using influencers in social channels?
I think at this point, at the time when I took this on the show, there weren't that many brands, but literally everybody's doing influencer marketing. So I'm not spending enough time really paying attention at this point to really tell you who's doing it well. Now the business, has shifted. Jerome went on to do other things. We've kind of actually shut down Grape Story at this point, and now we have an influencer media department within VaynerMedia. So the problem with the business was it was hard to scale because these kids got famous and they started going to bigger talent agencies because they still do want to do television and things of that nature. And so we wanted to end up representing everybody instead of representing a few, and that's where I shifted the business.
What's the difference between influencer marketing and product placement?
The education of the person executing the strategy of influencer marketing. For example, product placement is a tactic within influencer marketing. You can actually have a bottle of water. As a matter of fact, a water company reached out to me during Wine Library TV and said, hey, why don't you put your water on the table and we'll give you a couple of bucks. That's product placement. The other thing you could do is integrate full stories. They could take over your account. You could have them at events and collect content. There's a lot of executions you can do with that influencer. One of them happens to be you putting your product in their day in and day out content.
What is the role of influencers in my overall media strategy? And how do I evaluate them relative to other marketing channels?
Well, this is the billion-dollar question. I mean, everybody's struggling with the notion of how is my media mix being evaluated. When you're running television and direct mail and radio and outdoor media and social media and digital banner and Google AdWords and influencers and event marketing, how do you really figure this out? You don't unless you create very siloed executions with very direct ways to figure it out. Pepsi can't do that. Their product sells in stores. They don't know exactly how that person was influenced. And hence now why you have a big, big, big advertising industry where there's a lot of weirdness going on and a lot of assumptions that are not true. I think the percentage of spend against influencers needs to grow dramatically for most big companies in the world. And even for the people sitting here who have a very small company, you have a Raspberry Jam or you have a $200 ebook that you're selling, other people endorsing your products really works. And so it's just awareness. It's no different than any other media. And so what you have to do is make sure it doesn't feel like they're spamming their audience, because then you get the negative kind of vibe from that. But I'm a very big believer that it's underpriced. Clearly, it has a whole chapter in my book. I think it should be a bigger part of the percentage of your marketing than you think. And evaluating it, really, if you're lucky enough to be on both sides, omnichannel, all the way through, where you can actually see the sale. For example, Wine Library, no problem. Give somebody a bottle of wine, pay them to endorse it, link out to winelibrary.com. We can see it. Like, there's no debate. But again, for a soda company, you can't. And so you evaluate it the best you can with the best analytics and reporting that your organization has.
How do I evaluate the cost of an influencer on a case-by-case basis?
So this is very difficult. You need context. It's actually why I've integrated it into VaynerMedia so that we can actually base a CPM, cost per thousand impressions, on it and create a baseline for people to go off of. But the truth is you can't, because you can't just go on awareness. You need to think about effectiveness. It makes me think about when Luxury.com had a million emails for me back in the day for Wine Library. In 1997, I thought my business was going to explode when I bought an ad on it. And meanwhile, they sent it and nobody cared and there was no depth and nobody really bought, and I was crushed and overpaid for a million open emails but got no click-throughs. Same with an influencer. If you have an influencer who has 1,000 people following them, but 800 of them actually buy your peanut butter, and then you go to another one and they've got 40,000, and then they put out a post and only 28 buy them, well, who did you like? You evaluate based on on the results. The problem is most of us don't have a machine that allows us to quantify the results because we don't have the engine that sells the product unless we are a retailer. So, at the end of the day, you try to put things in a position. For example, what if you have an influencer, if you own 30 stores, only market people to a specific location, and you see if that location is doing better than the other locations or better than it has historically done. The problem with most marketers and business people is they don't know how to score. They score how many likes, they score how many people follow them, they don't score the results. Force your business into a results-driven play with an influencer, and then you treat it like you treat direct mail or any other thing that you do in marketing. You just look at the actual results.
My brand doesn't even have a Vine account. Should Vine be a platform I consider if it's not somewhere we're already active for brand development?
You should be anywhere where your customer is. So if you believe that the 13 to 27-year-old demo that still remains on Vine, which is smaller than it used to be, but is still there, is marketable and you can get them and they can drive your business, well, then you should be there. At the end of the day, that's no different than should we be in the Yellow Pages. I mean, who in the world thinks the Yellow Pages is a good idea? I bet you there's some company that markets to 75 to 95-year-olds that probably is still getting real results from the Yellow Pages. Wherever your audience is, you should be, especially if it's underpriced. Now, that said, when this was asked, Vine was bigger. It's declining. The attention's waning from it. So you've got to keep those factors in play always.
When you contract an influencer, do you instruct them to continue to make the kind of content your brand is already making, or should you let them speak with their own voice and on their own terms?
Number two. I mean, you're paying them because they did something right. Their audience likes the way they do it. For some of you classic marketers or just people of the world, remember how Howard Stern read his commercials? It wasn't exactly like the conservative disc jockey in middle America. You bought Howard for Howard, and you let Howard have a little fun with your brand. Same exact thing. It's literally disc jockey mentality. If you make them do something that's not native to them, everybody's going to sniff it from a million miles away, and it's going to come across really lame, and you'll probably spend money to suck. And so, so let these people do what they do. You've made the decision you believe in them. Don't get conservative at the last minute.
Can an influencer on Vine, Snapchat, or Instagram drive app downloads given the platform limitations against linking out? How can we prove that there's content directly affecting the KPI?
KPI, key performance indicator. It's a business term that allows people to understand, is it working? Like, this is how we measure success. This is what we're going for. Think of it as the goal. The answer is, of course, they have massive attention. As a matter of fact, one of the best arbitrages in the world for app downloads is influencers. The way you can do it is you can make your product, if you own the app, have a code maybe to create a special feature, and then you can give those influencers that code and say, go download this app and use Selena as a code. And not that they may get an extra gift. You might not be charging. It might be a free app, but it's a way for you to track it. Or don't do any other advertising for 30 days. Stop cold, wait 30 days, and then allow that influencer to plug, and then see what's happening. See if you get a spike. So it's actually very easy to measure if you're willing to measure and use a little common sense.
Hi, Gary Vaynerchuk. This is Philip Guinea from Berkshire Academy. Now, my question is, what is the tactical and strategic pathway to become an influencer? I am all in when it comes to all forms of marketing. How do I connect with real influencers, leverage their brand equity, or grow my own?
Well, first of all, asking how to become an influencer is like asking me, how do I become a star? The answer is have talent, you know, and be a star and be an influencer, meaning you've got to pump out content. You've got to bring it on the platform. You've got to be there first or early. I mean, at the end of the day, you can always pop on YouTube or Facebook or Snapchat or Instagram, but you got to be great. And you got to be greater once the supply and demand issues kick in, right? Because the land grab in the beginning is quite special. I think at the end of the day, it's much harder to become the next big influencer. For example, fuck Jerry or the fat Jewish on Instagram. You're not going to become the next that because they land grabbed. They filled that void. You have to fill a different void, or you need to be the joker on the next kind of platform. And so it's very basic. Do you have the skills? Did you move fast enough to land grab during that time? And did you bring value to your audience to maintain that early lead? You know what? I don't talk about this a lot. There was a lot of other Twitter and YouTube celebrity alikes when I was there. They've all faded away. They didn't have the chops. They were there early. They grabbed an early audience, but then they couldn't bring it. And so their lifespan was only as good as their talent allowed them to be. So I think the key two metrics are speed on which you get on these platforms, and two, do you actually have the talent to be an influencer? There's one other little thing, a crap load of work. The maintaining of content and value and information day in and day out, day in and day out, day in and day out. Chapter 12. Stop with the excuses. In this chapter, I'll talk about Gone with the Wind, how to make depressing content palatable, and raising the dead industries. Throughout the relatively short history of the Ask Gary Vee show, I fielded numerous questions from people convinced that their especially dull or outdated industry or uninspiring job poses a special marketing challenge. It's stunning how many remarkable reasons and circumstances people can come up with to explain why they haven't met with success. Of course, the problem doesn't usually lie with a type of industry or job. The problem lies with the individual who can't see opportunities when they're right in front of his or her face. There might not be any easier place to make your mark than an environment where few people, if any, are putting much effort into making their mark, or where everything has stayed the same since the dawn of time. What I find heartening is what often happens after I answer these kinds of questions. A high percentage of people will email me afterwards to say, "Hey, you were right," and tell me that my answer sparked the beginning of a mindset shift that led to rapid gains. I have no interest in being a motivational speaker, but it's scary and exciting to see how little it sometimes takes to change someone's perspective. Maybe we all look for excuses to explain why we don't achieve what we want to, and we should be more self-aware and recognize how much control we actually have over our own fate. Even taking into account the barriers like racism, sexism, nationalism that many of us have to face. It's amazing how as soon as you make the shift from "I can't" to "why can't I," you go from defense to offense. And as everyone knows, the best place to score is always on offense.
Hey guys, what's up? This is Draymond Green, forward for the Golden State Warriors, and I am super excited about reading the next 10 questions in the Ask Gary Vee book to you. Thanks a lot for having me. You are much appreciated. How do I create interesting content for a boring product or a stale industry?
A white lawyer defends a black man in a small southern town. A spoiled rich girl gets married 3 times and survives the Civil War. Boy meets girl. Recognize any of these? Shaved Down to Their Core, To Kill a Mockingbird, Gone with the Wind, and Romeo and Juliet sound pretty damn boring. Their lasting power lies in fresh, imaginative, daring, surprising storytelling of their creators. There is no boring if you tell your story right. What really gets me excited about this question is just living my life. For so many years, people came up to me and said, "Gary, you're so lucky though, especially with Crush It and as my brand was building. You're so lucky, Gary. You have wine. That's an interesting category. That's why you were successful." Which, you know, if you know me, that pissed me off to no end, because I wanted to remind people that before me, wine was held in a very esteemed place in the U.S. People talked down to people about it. If anything, people were intimidated about wine. Yeah, there was a small subset, normally in the affluent world, of people that were intrigued by wine. But the people that I was reaching and the people that were getting excited about wine and get excited about me, these were beer drinkers. These were 23-year-old dudes. These were 31-year-old females that had never been exposed to the wine world. They thought about wine 3 times a year. Thanksgiving, this, that, and the other thing. It wasn't that interesting. It's just I created interest around it. And if you look back, if you look at Jim Cramer, you know, is that really interesting? Is Wall Street interesting to people that don't care about making money on Wall Street? The answer is no. And I can break down everything, including things that we've accepted, like sports and music. By the way, I'm not that interested in music, but Casey Kasem in the morning as a kid on radio got me excited about it. If you know how to storytell, especially if you have two things, listen to me and listen to me good. And this is a very, very important part of this audiobook. If you have passion, like you really love it, like you really love it, and because a lot of you love a lot of things, and you have expertise. Everybody knew I had passion with Wine Library TV. What everybody forgot is the day I started that show, I'd been in that industry for more than half my life. That at 14, 15, 16, and 17 years old, before I was 30 when I started the show, I was reading The Wine Spectator, becoming educated. That from 21 to 30, I was tasting and drinking 50 wines a day, buying for one of the biggest companies in the country, becoming deeply educated. So when I had all my charisma and I was excited, I could also have the chops for the people that actually cared about learning. If you have those two things, you can win. Whether you're building jet engines, if you're doing carpeting, I'm looking at the carpet right now as I read this. I'm bored as hell with carpets, but I promise you, if you're listening right now and you are passionate about carpets, you know interior design, if you don't think that you can make a Snapchat or Instagram or YouTube show that explodes your carpet business, well, then you're not paying attention to what's happened over the last 10 years, and more importantly, what's going to happen over the next 10 years. There is absolutely no boring product if you're actually in business. Let me say that again. There is absolutely no boring product if you're actually in business. If people are buying it, they have an interest. Maybe it's not the most interesting thing in the world. They have an interest about saving money on it, using it properly. It may be a utility, not an entertainment. But if you're lucky enough to be selling a utility, something people need, and if you can just add a little bit of entertainment, then you've got gold.
How can a nonprofit that works to solve a serious problem like human trafficking make depressing content dynamic?
Before I go any further, big shout out to Draymond Green, who's reading this. I'm a huge Knicks fan. When he was a free agent, I became friendly with him. We're about to be a free agent. My brother and I desperately tried to convince him to come to the Knicks. For him, it looks like he's made the right choice. Anyway, very serious topic here. Look, I think dynamic is the important part of this question. I think a lot of people are caught up in not understanding that you don't have to make something humorous and funny, which I think people default to on Twitter and YouTube and places like this. How do you make a serious problem dynamic? The same way that every great documentary with depressing music or serious music, with the right editing and cuts. I mean, look, you can put out facts. Instagram is incredible for putting out content with like some wording over it, like one in every three children X. You can make the content very dynamic. Books and magazines and New York Times articles and documentaries and movies have done this forever. I just went and saw Spotlight, a movie that was very dark. It was dynamic. It was dynamic. It wasn't up. You're not asking me how do you make this uplifting. You're also not asking me how do you make everybody care about it. You're asking me how to make it dynamic, which is the hope of making everybody care about it. I think you deliver it with the seriousness that it deserves, but I think you DJ it into the world. I'm more likely to see in my stream somebody share on Instagram or Facebook a picture of a child or a depressing photo that has, did you know? I love did you know. It makes the brain think. Did you know one in every three people in Asia? Da, da, da. There's so many ways to do this. So I think you have to respect the context of the platforms, which is the religion of everything that I talk about. But you need to recognize, and I hear this a lot, you don't have to make it funny. You don't have to make it pretty. You have to make it authentic and real, but contextual so it actually gets to people's faces.
My goal is to wake the dead, aka the funeral business. What are your thoughts on bringing relevance to a gray-haired industry?
So I'm going to take this in two parts. On the show, I answered this very directly and talked about a very far-fetched idea of like becoming a leader in reviewing flowers or sourcing flowers, because I was making the connection of what's the lightest heart thing I could talk about in a funeral. A lot of flower action going on there. You know, I've actually rethought this a little bit, and this is why the audiobook is so fun compared to the book. I mean, that is still true, but I do think that's a Hail Mary. I think there's another way to look at it, which is kind of a little bit of this chapter's theme, which is where are people going to be playing in our world that are going to be dealing with these issues? I would say that that's Facebook. One of the things that you could be doing in marketing is actually marketing in a 5 to 25 mile radius, which is what a funeral home, I think, is oftentimes going to be getting business from. And you could be marketing towards, I mean, this is very just real. I mean, I'm kind of like, you can see my energy going in a different direction. You're a funeral home. If I grew up in that business, right now and I was running it, I would run ads on a 25-mile radius because I would assume that my business was probably doing better within a 5-mile radius. You start going out that far, there's other places to go. And the truth is I would be targeting 50 to 75-year-olds on Facebook because I'm going to make assumptions that their relatives and, more importantly, their parents are probably the ones that are starting to pass. And honestly, where I would go with this is I would write content and I would produce content and I would make videos and pictures that would say things like, what would you like to see us do? So I'm thinking about, you know, I'm hitting a 68-year-old in their Facebook feed because that's where they're living right now. Let's remember, let's take a step back for every business here, for any gray-haired business. The enormous usage of 50 to 80-year-olds on Facebook right now is at scale, real scale. This is not a Snapchat demo yet. And so, you know, I think a lot of them are dealing emotionally now with their parents in homes, their parents being sick, you know, them being concerned about that. And I think getting feedback from them on a what would you like to see us do to make these moments better, or you'll get people who've just went through it and said this was bad or good from other places. I think you start building a little bit of a community. You start making a connection. And at the end of the day, business is about connections. The amount of wine I sell at Wine Library because I went to high school with somebody that has a coworker with that person at Merck in New Jersey. It's just a little lightweight connection. That's what content allows you to do. And it doesn't always have to be a piece of advertising. Sometimes it needs to be a piece of conversation. And I think this industry needs a piece of conversation. And very honestly right now, I have goosebumps because I'm reminded why I'm doing this audiobook. Because I'm just as human as anybody else. And the truth is, this answer is 8,000 times better than the answer I gave on the Ask Gary Vee show just 6 months ago. So that got me excited. Chapter 13. Gratitude. In this chapter, I talk about what I do when things get tough, how to romance your audience, and how to build lifetime value. Real quick, before I get into this, I also want to do a little off-the-script moment. I love gratitude. I'm convinced that it is what is driving me. And I did make this chapter 13 because I know a lot of people are weird about the number 13. And I like taking negative things and trying to make them positive. So this is not a by accident. Chapter 13 is gratitude on purpose because I'm going to brand the number 13 in a positive way starting right now. I'm often asked what fuels me. And 80% of the time, my answer is gratitude. I'm glad I was born in a communist country and got to move to this great country where capitalism is revered and appreciated. I'm thankful that I haven't had a lot of pain in my life, though it's because I've lost 3 of my 4 grandparents before I ever got to know them. I'm grateful for the best mom in the world, for the best wife in the world, for a dad who taught me not to be full of shit, and for all the people I love. I won't say that I know how to teach you to have more gratitude, but I can say that if it is something that can be developed, you should go figure out how. Gratitude is my weapon in my day-to-day life. Period. Being an entrepreneur or a CEO is stunningly lonely. That's not talked about much, though it did get discussed more frequently recently as we've seen some suicides in the tech industry. As the head of a company, you are the last person in the line of defense. You are entirely responsible for everything. It's a huge eye-opener when you realize that you are responsible not only for yourself and your family and loved ones, but for the other people in your business too. The enormity of that obligation hit me hard when I was a kid building up Wine Library to 150 employees and weighs on me even more now with VaynerMedia at 600 plus. Keeping that commitment front of mind while battling all the competitors trying to beat you and put you out of business, all while navigating dynamics you can't control, from Wall Street to geopolitics, can weigh heavily even when you're not faced with business catastrophes like losing an important deal or going out of business. Gratitude is what's gotten me through my toughest moments in business. Yes, there have been some, though I don't like to talk about them much. Whenever I have lost a deal to a competitor or an incredible employee or $1 million in revenue because a state changed its wine shipping laws, that's right, you Texas, I default to gratitude because I recognize that even if I had invested in Uber and Woody Johnson decided it was time that I buy the New York Jets tomorrow, none of it would matter to me at all if I got a call the next day and somebody told me somebody I loved was sick or was dying. Keeping that perspective allows me to handle anything and everything. Whenever I've been in my loneliest place with my biggest headaches, Thank God I've been able to step away from it and remind myself of all the great things that I've been given. It's impossible to complain and get too down when you realize that. Gratitude is what allows me to live my life the way I do, but it's also a core element to the way I do business. I never, ever take it for granted when people take minutes out of their ridiculously busy days to watch my show, or read my blogs, or my books, or listen to my books. I spend much of my time online trying to thank my fans, followers, customers as often as possible. I don't understand why more brands and businesses don't make this their mission. It's not as if customers are limited to their neighborhoods or even their cities to find what they need or want anymore. The world is at their fingertips. It seems to me that when the competition is that widespread, you should be falling all over yourself, thanking every damn customer who decides to spend any time or money with you.
Hey guys, it's Draymond Green again for Chapter 13. Any thoughts on how to use social to promote nonprofits that are selling an experience and a culture rather than a product?
So, you know, it's funny. Before I go into this, I should say this. Nonprofits, NGOs, may be the worst marketers in the world because of something that pisses me off, and that's called entitlement. They think just because they're doing good in the world that every single person should give them money. And that's just truth. I don't know what else to tell you. I've been around this for a long time. As my profile has exploded in the last 7 or 8 years, it is stunning to me. Out of the worst, spammiest internet marketer who just jumps on my Twitter account or email and asks me for money is still better at it. Still better at that douchey move than every NGO that hits me up. The audacity that they just tweet me like, hey Gary, give $500 right now. Like, do it. Do it. Like, it's insane to me without even saying hello because I have a million Twitter followers. They're like, Gary, retweet this. No relationship. None. Zero. They come in right for the right hook and it comes in hard. And let me promise you, it misses even harder than the spammiest of spam marketers because of that entitlement. And so what NGOs and nonprofits have to realize is, number one, they have to act like everybody else. They can't go into this mission thinking that they're going to get money from everybody just because they're doing good. There's a million organizations doing good. There's also tens of thousands of businesses doing good. There's tens of millions of people doing good. I mean, I've been very active in this world, sometimes debate, am I giving too much for these organizations and not my inner friends and family? I mean, this is a real debate. This is real life. Let's get to the chase here, everybody. So taking a step back, the thing they do have, and I'm very active in Charity Water. I'm a Well member. I'm on the board of Pencils of Promise. These organizations are doing incredible things. They have nothing but stories. I promise you, as somebody who tries to storytell for bottled waters and soap and tires, it's a lot easier to do it for people that are building wells for people in Africa or building schools for people in Laos. This is an incredible opportunity for NGOs to take a step back and realize they're media companies. You gotta tell your stories. And yes, you can do like great things like only $2 a day feeds. Yes, those are smart things. You need to do what I've been talking about throughout this book, what I wrote about in Jab, 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 Right Hook. But what you have to start with, and I know a lot of you are listening right now, what you have to start with is you're not entitled. Nobody owes you a penny. You know, especially when times are tough, you know your donations go down. You've got to start at that religious place that you are not deserving of that money any more than somebody buying a pair of Nikes. It's just not the way it is. And if you do that, all of a sudden you try harder. All of a sudden you hire better people. It just changes everything. And I've seen the organizations that do it that way and think of themselves as a consumer packaged good or a media company are doing much better than the people that just walk in and are just saying, well, we deserve it because we're doing great in the world. It's the audacity that's holding so many people back.
Do you still believe marketing is headed toward one-on-one marketing?
One of the great excitements and disappointments in my career is that the thank you economy, a book I wrote back and probably wrote it in 2010, came out in 2011, is just not as true as I thought it was back then. Let me tell you why I'm disappointed and excited. I'm disappointed because I hate being wrong. And the truth is, if you asked me 6 years ago, did I think we'd be further along in businesses and organizations caring about consumers on a one-to-one basis? The answer is yes. I'm excited because I continue to make money by doing it. As a matter of fact, if you have the opportunity to have your phone by you right now, if you're not listening on the phone or if you're not driving, I don't want anybody into an accident, but tweet me right now, at Gary VEE, if you bought this audiobook because I one-on-one engaged you. because I replied to something, because I responded to your email, because I said hello on Snapchat, because I hearted your tweet, liked your Facebook post. Tell me, because here's the good news. It's a lot of you. Because effort and engagement on one-to-one level really matters. It's the purest form of sales. Anybody who's listening right now and knows what a CRM is, which is a consumer management kind of tool, knows that if you can really get there, you will win. I just think that, yes, the world is heading there, and I do think we're going to see a lot more over the next 10 to 15 years evolution. You've seen it with the sales forces and things of that nature. I think one-to-one marketing continues to have massive upside. What I'm starting to realize is the following. The market will go there, but it's going to be a small percentage of people, and that small percentage of people are going to make a shitload of money. Period. Chapter 14, Leadership. In this chapter, I'll talk about the biggest lessons I've learned building culture.